I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Gay culture over the last 50 years or so has changed the perspective on all of us. Our guest this hour has a fresh perspective on the gay perspective. Keith Fleming was rescued from a miserable adolescence by his gay uncle, the writer Edmund White. After Keith Fleming's parents broke up, his mother discovered she was gay. His father had his son locked up in a series of mental institutions. And then Uncle Ed came to the rescue and brought his nephew to live in his own Upper West Side apartment in New York City. Keith Fleming says it was under his uncle's influence that he became a new and better person. Edmund White introduced his nephew to Proust, Nabokov, Handel, to suits from Barney's, and a dermatologist who cleared up his skin. Keith Fleming also had a front row seat on the New York gay scene at its height. Keith Fleming's memoir of his own adolescence is called The Boy with the Thorn in His Side. It's a kind of straight observation of a gay observatory in New York. If gay sexuality before and after the AIDS onset has had a liberating effect on the culture overall, Keith Fleming learned that lesson at a young age. He's here with his uncle, Edmund White. Edmund White's new novel is called The Married Man. Edmund White has been called America's most wide-ranging gazetteer of gay experience. Connection listeners, what have we learned? What has gay life taught us about straight life, about life itself, about sexuality, friendship, marriage, child-rearing? The phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK to make the connection with the writers Edmund White and his nephew Keith Fleming. Keith, you're the star. We're interested in your whole story, but we're especially interested in what you learned about life from Uncle Eddie.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is I learned from my uncle that usually straight men have a hard time confiding their troubles to each other. So he pointed out that straight men just start teasing and scoffing if you try to tell them about any of your problems, so that straight men are are usually forced to go to women to talk about their problems. And I've thought that that's true, and I've often wished that we straight men could emulate the gay men that I've seen who are able to be complete friends to each other.
Do gay men do it differently? What's the difference?
Well, the gay men that I've know, it seems to me that they are the way that in the way that women friends can tell each other their worst problems and not feel embarrassed about it.
For example, and how did it bear on a, you know, your own conversation in a very troubled time in your own life?
Well, I think first of all, when I came as a 16-year-old to live with my uncle, I suppose I learned that I could sometimes tell him, "Oh, Uncle Ed, I'm really feeling terrible that my girlfriend is in a convent in Chicago." Maybe if he'd been a straight uncle, I would have picked up that that would have made him uncomfortable to hear me confessing private emotion.
And what did Uncle Ed have to say?
Well, he eventually brought this girlfriend to live with me in New York, so...
What more can an uncle do?
Right.
It intrigues me that you know, you couldn't apparently talk about that with your father or with other men in your world.
Yeah, I don't know what your male listeners would have to say about this, but it does seem to me still true. If I'm feeling panicked about my dwindling bank account, I'm not going to go to even a good male friend and say, "Oh, gee, I couldn't sleep last night because I'm going broke." It would be a woman I'd be more likely to confide that to.
What's our problem, Evan White?
Well, I think
how
one...
do gay men get around it?
I'm not even sure I agree.
Why can't straight men talk about, you know, a short bank account?
I don't think I agree with my nephew about that, because I think that, in fact, straight men, I think, are actually warmer with each other than gay men are, because I think gay men are always afraid that their signals, their warmth, will, at least amongst each other, will be interpreted as a come-on. So they tend to be rather cold with each other and don't even touch each other very often. I think that it's amazing, like, if you're in... I remember once being in group therapy, a marathon group therapy over a weekend with all gay men, And one guy started sobbing, and nobody got up to touch him. And the therapist, who also had straight groups, said, you know, if you guys were a bunch of straight guys, you'd be up embracing each other and taking care of each other. But as gay guys, you're just sitting there. So I really think that there's a strong possibility that this is an exaggeration. I do think that with my nephew...
I'm simply repeating what you told me 25 years ago.
Well, I probably don't believe it anymore.
Yeah.
I think I changed my mind. Because I think I used to think that gays were a lot warmer than straights, but I don't anymore.
But you, if you're upset in love, can you tell a good old gay friend about how you feel bad?
Sure, yeah.
Now, I couldn't do that with a straight male friend. I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that.
I bet a lot of straight guys would, though.
I don't know about that.
What if the truth is somewhat, you know, maybe both? It seems to me gay men have made it possible for straight men to be so much better with each other.
Well, I
and women have done the same thing for men, too, in certain ways. I mean, made it fashionable to get close, get open, get real. Is this possible?
Yeah, even though I've also heard it said that women want men who are sensitive to them, not about their own problems.
Keith, I wish you'd... Maybe you just tell your story.
Yeah.
Where were you at age 14? What was going on? And what in the world did you make of Manhattan?
Yeah. I was little. I was 16. When I first arrived, I guess you could say it was almost a not a shattering experience, but it was a real eye-opener in every way. In the simplest physical sense... my uncles, having sent me immediately to a dermatologist, kind of started making me take my first steps into feeling at all unmiserable about my own appearance. And, you know, his throwing away the plaid pants and the flowered shirt that I'd brought from Chicago and replacing it with some of his old clothes, an Italian shirt, a jean jacket. And in other ways, I was very mystified at first by what exactly the relationship was between my uncle and his roommate, an actor named Keith McDermott. I think at first I assumed that they were a couple, but then when I heard them joking around together, they'd each tell me, oh, you know, the payphone down below on the street corner, well, your uncle and I, we each know the phone number, so that if a cute trick, you know, a good-looking guy happens to be walking past the phone, we can ring it. And so then I thought, oh, well, they're just buddies. But it turned out in the end that they were friends, but my uncle was, in fact, unhappily in love with this Keith McDermott. It was the first thing I'd heard that made me feel I was in any way helping my uncle myself, because Uncle Ed said to me, well, your being here is distracting me from how unhappy I've been living with this roommate that I'm in love with but who doesn't love me.
What did gay and straight mean to you at a time in a boy's life when all of these things are confusing and vaguely... threatening as well as enormously kind of enticing.
Well, I wonder if it would have been more overwhelming if I hadn't had this girlfriend who I'd met in the Chicago mental hospital I'd been in just before, and who was writing regular love letters to me, and who a half year later ended up coming to live with me in New York in an apartment that Ed rented for us. So I had in my mind, well, here I have this girlfriend who's writing me all the time. So maybe that left me secure enough to just take pride in feeling I was very cool and precocious to now know all these things about gay men that very few other 16-year-old boys would know. You know, I knew that if you put a handkerchief in your right back pocket, what did it mean? It meant you were the active one, or was it the other way around? But on Christopher Street in the West Village, I went once or twice with my uncle, and there was all this parading around, and people would wear different colored handkerchiefs in their back pockets that would signal their sexual tastes. And I learned from my uncle and his friends that they called a man's crotch his basket, so they would... I kind of just thought it was cool just to now I knew that, oh, that's what basket is, you know, as in, look at that, get a load of that basket.
Your uncle was openly and rather eminently a writer about the gay scene at that time. Did you talk about sex? Did you want to talk about the issue?
It wasn't in any way that would make either of us squeamish, but we did get very silly in the kitchen together, and we came up with something we called the icky system. And I think, in retrospect, this is very amusing, because here was my uncle going out every night in his leather jacket and having sex with strangers. And yet he, far from feeling, conceited about all of this action he was having, he and I came up with this icky system, which was a system that saw all sex as to some degree icky, so that he would say, well, the guy last night, I think the sex with him was maybe -3 ickies, and the best that any sex could be would be -1 icky.
The best it could be.
Right.
I think one of the things that's...
Are we revealing something new here in the icky system?
Well, I think, just taking an overview of the whole thing, I think one of the things that's that happened was that Keith came from a fairly middle-class background, and what he was suddenly in touch with was a very bohemian world. I mean, in which... promiscuity was an open book. We didn't have any money. We thought that artists shouldn't have money. That there was a tradition of honorable poverty. I would open my checkbook and show Keith and his girlfriend Laura exactly how much I had, and it was sometimes only a matter of $100 or $200. I took a serious job in order to pay for their private schools. So, I mean, in other words, I think that it was a very kind of free-for-all bohemian world in which there was very little distance between an adult of 35 and a teenager of 15. I mean, I think we were all sort of interested in the same things, having a good time, going out, getting laid, and I think that, and sort of living on the wing. So I think that was really the thing, was that it was an introduction to an artistic and bohemian world that was very different from the middle-class suburban world that he came from.
You were suddenly a parent, without exactly planning it. I mean, what did you take your mission to be? It's one thing to live a bohemian life on your own, but suddenly here's a young life in your hands. What and the model, the things you, especially the things that Keith emphasizes as sort of emblematic, Barney's, Proust, the dermatologist, were as well as motorcycle jackets and sex with strangers every night, was such an interestingly mixed bag. What was the project here?
Well, I certainly wasn't trying to introduce him to gay sex. In fact, I remember at least having defended him against that. I mean, when friends of mine would make insinuations that maybe he might be gay, that would drive me into a fury. And my roommate...
How did those things come up?
I mean, people would come by and they'd say, oh, well, you're getting awfully limp-wristed, Keith, or whatever. Do you know, I mean, they would sort of suggest that he was picking up on the gayness of the household. And my roommate and I never embraced each other or ever embraced anybody else in front of him or ever were nude in front of him, which, I mean, in other words, we may have been bohemian, but we also had rather strict ideas that we'd worked out so that we wouldn't be imposing our lifestyle or our sexuality on him. And maybe that didn't strike him because they were sort of things that didn't need to be discussed, really. But
yeah, because you're saying, he's suggesting what I've said, I don't even remember that. And I think my own example would suggest that our sexuality is probably hardwired into us from the beginning, so that I really do think of it in terms of, it would be just as hard to make me gay as it would be to make my uncle, who hates sports, enjoy playing tennis. I mean, I could spend 50 years trying to get him to like tennis, and he could spend 50 years trying to make me think gay sex was something that I would want to do. But we would never even want to do that, because we know who each other are.
That's the hardwiring. But then there's the culture. Then there's the psychology. What did you make of Uncle Ed's life? And there you were, sort of smitten as a teenager with the girl rescued from the convent.
Yeah.
What did you make of sex with strangers, promiscuity, the bohemian shtick?
Well, I think that most teenage boys, I would think, would feel the same way I did, which is you admire someone, you think he's cool. I mean, just in a physical sense, if my father was overweight, balding, and dressed in brown shoes from Florsheim's, my uncle was in great shape, looked, you know, like he was in a rock band or something. And so that's a good start. And I think that any teenage boy would admire someone who's so successfully managing to both make a life for himself and have a lot of fun in the evenings. And that's what my uncle seemed to be juggling so well.
Did he let you in on the sort of the cultural arguments of the day when AIDS arrived, for example? I mean...
Oh, I see. That would have been after I would have left, because this would have been 1976 and 77. So I think the issues of that day were...
I
remember Anita Bryant and her... What was it that she was...
Well, she was a sort of Christian right leader who was the orange juice queen.
We weren't supposed to drink. I remember we all couldn't drink orange juice.
That's right.
In protest against her.
Yeah. That's right.
Zealous.
I mean, Keith arrived in New York during the sort of first flush of confidence in gay liberation. Mm-hmm. It was before AIDS. It was after Stonewall. Stonewall, the beginning of gay liberation, was 1969. AIDS began in 1981. So there's a decade, really, of freedom and of bliss, and that in which promiscuity was not only permitted but was encouraged. And I think it was a sort of the heyday, really, of gay culture. And also in 1977, when my nephew was living with me, that was the year when lots of gay novels came out, including my own book, Nocturnes for the King of Naples. But it was sort of the beginning of gay fiction. And my nephew, who is a writer and who was always interested in writing, I think was very stimulated by that, too, in living up close with somebody who was a working writer.
1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with the writers, Edmund White and his nephew, Keith Fleming. Keith Fleming's new book is called The Boy with the Thorn in His Side. It's a memoir of growing up as a teenager with his uncle, even then, and still more now, the famous gay writer, Edmund White. 1-800-423-TALK is the phone. Scott is on the line.
Hello, Edmund.
Welcome, Scott.
Hi, and Keith. First of all, I wanted to ask, Edmund, how you're doing. I know you're living with AIDS, and I hope you're well.
I don't have AIDS. I'm HIV positive. That is, I'm one of those people who's called a non-progressor, and I've been positive that I know of since 85, and my counts are still the same now as they were then. I've never taken any medicines or anything. So, but thanks for asking. No, it's great.
Yeah, I saw you at Harvard a couple of years ago reading from your book about your life in Paris, and you looked great, and so I'm really glad you sound wonderful.
Thanks.
But I also wanted to ask Keith, if you could comment on a recurring theme in Edmund's novel seems to be the contrast between emotional reality and objective reality, you know, the sort of truth and artifice. And if you could comment on some of the, you know, differences between how he's portrayed things in some of his books versus what you experienced.
Oh, I see. Well, yeah, it's interesting. I know I had started a few years ago to write a biography of my uncle's life, and I had found that his first autobiographical novel, really, was A Boy's Own Story about his own boyhood. And I learned that in real life, he'd been far wilder than the boy in A Boy's Own Story. For example, in real life, he started picking up... married men as a 13-year-old in the a subway men's toilet.
Oh, my God.
And I think he made a shrewd decision to make his boy hero a little less precocious and thus more more of an someone that all readers could relate to. And I actually took a page from that in my own memoir, in that I found myself editing out some things that would have made me seem a little too weird. But thanks for asking.
You didn't take your own advice then.
Well, I did. I mean, in other words, I could have put weirder things in my... If the advice from my uncle was, don't take out some of the weirdest things about yourself when you write about yourself, to make yourself a little more ordinary, I took that advice.
You took uncle's example.
Right.
Scott, does that do it?
Well, I was wondering, were you at all taken aback by any of the descriptions that you read in Edmund's books about things that you experienced compared to your own recollections?
Well, yeah, I think he is, in some ways, about my book. I think it's unavoidable, because we never quite agree with how others remember things, and especially how they portray us in every aspect. So my advice to anyone is just to write your own book and set the record straight.
Scott, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 is the connection phone. 1-800-423-TALK with Keith Fleming and his uncle Edmund White. Mark is calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Good morning.
Morning, Mark.
For Mr. White, I have a question, and it has to do with a comment that he made a few minutes ago about not showing affection, making sure not to show affection towards his roommate and his friends when Keith was around, because he didn't want to influence him or impose his, as Mr. White called it, which is a term that I deplore, but anyway, lifestyle on his nephew. And I was wondering if that was a product of the times, or does he feel that way today as well? Because it sounds like it has a little bit of internalized homophobia in there. And would he do it differently today?
Well, I think that raising children makes everybody more conservative than they think they are normally. I mean, for instance, look at all the people who are actually either agnostic or atheist, who, once they have children, begin to send them to Sunday school. I mean, and they'll say it's to keep all of his options open. But the truth is that once you have this sacred burden of raising a child on your hands, you do become more conservative. And I felt that it would have been out of place, if I'd been straight, to be embracing various girlfriends in front of my nephew. I wouldn't have done that either. But, I mean, that's the kind of stuffy guy I am.
Mark?
I think I'm thinking of embracing as a friendly hug and all, but you make it...
Oh, there was plenty of embracing, Mark, in the apartment there. In fact, I could often expect a kiss on my cheek as I returned home from school.
But he's worried about ingrained homophobia.
Well, I think everybody, I mean, certainly anybody of my, I'm 60 now, and I think anybody of my generation who basically came of age before Stonewall, that is, I was really a product of the 50s, obviously you're going to live with all the wounds of internalized homophobia. I agree with you. And every year, you know, it's like Chekhov said, he spent his whole life trying to root out the slave within him. And I think every gay man of my generation has to spend every year trying to root out the homophobia that's within him.
Keith, how did you, I mean, what is your own meter on homophobia?
You mean why it exists?
Well, I just wonder, I mean, what, I think, you know, every boy grows up with a degree of it and a puzzlement about it.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember my attitude as a teenager, and I think it was nothing so moral as a general view. I think it was a kind of person by person impression, and I think, in other words, my uncle and his gay friends in New York all struck me as wonderful looking and intelligent people that I would admire no matter what they were. But I'm sure you could you could have given me back then an example of a gay person that I might have thought, oh, well, that person makes being gay seem creepy. But you could have, on the other hand, given me a straight person that would have made being straight seem.
Let me ask. I mean, there are so many positive things we talk about that we've learned from gay culture, but also I wonder about the negatives. What is the lifetime impact, you think, of the example of the promiscuity of that period, and of the example of sex with strangers? What is the example on what is the lesson about intimacy in life in general that you learned in that period?
Yeah, well, I wonder if my uncle would be the better one to talk about that.
Well, I mean, I look at you. You've been for 10 years with the same woman and utterly faithful, as far as I know. And so it seems to me that it certainly didn't lead you to a life of promiscuity.
Right. Yeah.
But was that something you were sort of teaching yourself against the grain of your experience with your Uncle Ed? I mean, your Uncle Ed has written about not only sex with strangers, but romance as a matter of brief affairs.
Right.
And long-term relationship, if any, with nobody.
Right. Well, I think what my book does explore is the very tricky way that we, in some ways, can be truly influenced and change our ways because of a mentor. But in other ways, we're kind of incorrigibly ourselves. And so it occurs to me that...
Leave it there for just a minute. We'll come back to it. I like the idea of being incorrigibly ourselves. Keith Fleming and Edmund White are our guests. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston University, this is I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest, Keith Fleming, has written a new book, his first book, called The Boy with the Thorn in His Side, a memoir of growing up with his famously gay, prolific, authorial uncle, Edmund White. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection. Keith Fleming, you've just spoken about...
Being incorrigibly ourselves.
A conclusion, that we're incorrigibly ourselves. It's a great gift to discover that. And sometimes it takes a while. How did it come to you?
Well, for example, my uncle had told me when I was living with him back in the 70s as a teenager that I shouldn't feel jealous simply because my girlfriend at that time was having sex with other men. Because after all, he said, what we're really jealous of is simply whether we think that she might care more for these other men. And since she obviously cared the most for me, I should not really be feeling any jealousy. And that's something that, you know, I've never been able to convert philosophy. Well, I don't think it is. I think, at least for me, it's something so ingrained that I don't think I could make a philosophical change of heart about it. And in the same way, my uncle is someone who is very adept at doing what for me would be a dizzying amount of things. It seems like he always has this whirlwind of things going on around him every day that I would just simply find overwhelming. So again, I've had his example. I've admired him, you know, more than half my life. And yet I'm aware that I could, there are many things in the way that he lives that I, you know, would be very bad for me to attempt to emulate, and I never would want to, since I know that if I spent one day in his shoes, I would just be exhausted and reeling, you know, from the overstimulation, I think.
Your whole story sort of calls to mind that modern wisdom, I guess, that in a world of sort of changing families and whatnot, that what we all need more than anything is one person who's absolutely nuts about us growing up. And it can be a grandparent, it can be a teacher perhaps, it can be a gay uncle. And to a certain degree, it may not matter who it is. Is that your conclusion?
Yeah, I found it very interesting that a woman psychologist, after reading my book, had said, you know, this really shows that children don't necessarily need a nuclear family. They just simply need an adult who is there for them and cares about them. And so whenever I hear about people debating whether professional gay people should be allowed to adopt children, say, to me that always seems so absurd, since I know from reading the newspapers that there's so many neglected children, and I suppose, and so many children who are locked in to houses with fathers like my own who have no time for them, whatever, that it seems a shame to eliminate any able-bodied adult who's willing to put a lot of energy, and it takes a lot of energy, to raise a kid.
I just wonder if we really believe that, though, even if I believe it myself, that one can substitute for parents who really drop the ball, as they did in your case.
Well, I don't know. You mean you don't know how perhaps my example was an exceptional one?
Well,
saying?
Yeah.
I guess it, yeah.
Well, I felt that my nephew was in a mental hospital, 2 years were you?
1 year.
1 year. And he was, sitting around drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, and talking about his problems, not going to school, and was really falling way behind his classmates. And yet I knew he was very bright. But I hadn't really seen him in a long time. The minute he got to New York, I realized how intelligent he was. I put him in a thing called the tutoring school, where there was one-on-one teaching, and he immediately benefited from that and was soon able to join his age mates in school and eventually go on to the University of Chicago. So I felt like that was my major accomplishment. When he arrived, he wanted to go to a psychiatrist, and I said, no, you've had enough psychiatry. No more of that.
Actually, I never did. It's funny you said that.
Uh-huh. Really?
That would have been the last thing I would have wanted to go
to. Oh, I remember. Oh,
I hadn't had a very good impression of psychiatry, had I? I mean, I'd had someone who threatened me in the middle of the night. I mean,
yeah, another example.
But I think you might be confusing it with you had a longing. You did have psychiatrists when you were a teenager.
All my life, yeah. For 25 years, yeah. I had psychiatrists, yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Is it unresolved? Is it whether you did or didn't want?
Well, I guess it'll never be resolved because it's so far in the past. But I can't imagine coming out of this mental ward and saying, oh, can I please go see another psychiatrist?
But my original question was, you know, to what degree sort of the unqualified love of one person on a child can make all the difference.
Well, of course, we're not talking really about a child. I mean, you were how old when you came? 15?
Right.
15. So, and he seemed to me really, in many ways, quite adult. You know, I thought, I mean, we're not talking about a 5-year-old. We're talking about a 15-year-old who was a boy who had sort of fallen off the edge of the earth. I mean, who had gone to Maoist schools that his very liberal parents had sent him to, and which wasn't really very adequate schooling. And then he had had this contretemps with his father and stepmother and been put in a mental hospital. So it seemed to me that he was sort of off of the middle-class track. I mean, the paradox is that it was this bohemian gay uncle, me, who got him back into the middle-class world.
Right.
More power to you. 1-800-423-8255 is the connection phone. 1-800-423-TALK with Edmund White and Keith Fleming. Julie is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Julie. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks. Great show, Chris.
Thank you.
My question is for, it's actually about the female influences in your speaker's life, and if growing up in a bohemian gay atmosphere decreased the type of female stereotypes that he may have had growing up in the 70s and 80s with a nuclear family.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, well, I certainly always had the example of my mother, my uncle's sister, before me, and I'd seen how she emerged from problems with alcoholism, and in fact, she'd been in a mental hospital earlier, and I saw her transform herself into a very successful psychotherapist in the end. So I guess that I'm not quite sure what else you would want me to comment on.
Julie, do you want to follow up?
Well, I guess my question is, you know, a lot of people in the 70s had moms who stayed at home and cooked and cleaned and did a lot of that kind of stuff, and the dads went out and worked. And you had kind of the opposite experience. And I'm wondering if your view of women now you think is different as a result of that.
Yeah, it could be. That's an interesting thought. I know that, as my uncle mentioned a few minutes ago, I've been living for the last 10 years with an extremely hardworking academic, and she is someone who, you know, is the opposite, again, of a housewife type. And if anything, I think in some ways, if we have any roles, maybe I'm more the wife, in that I'm kind of more the emotional one, the more open one, and the slightly more charming one.
Well, thanks a lot. Sounds like you've had a wonderful experience.
Yeah, thanks.
Julie, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with Keith Fleming and his uncle Edmund White. Keith Fleming, among other things, I mean, there was just a plain education here. Uncle Ed introduced you to books, to writers, to serious music, to the world of art. What stands out?
Well, one of the thoughts, I mean, my book sort of spans my whole adolescence. So before I came under the influence of my uncle, what was there was there was a school where Bob Dylan and the Beatles were always being played in the alcove by older kids. And so for a while I went with that. And then there was a teacher who got us all the Little Red Book, Chairman Mao's Little Red Book, and that seemed interesting. And then this sadistic psychiatrist I had, who was waking us up in the middle of the night and threatening to send us to this Elon, which is back in the news now. It's the person who's alleged to have killed Martha Moxley, this Kennedy cousin. He supposedly confessed at this Elon. But by the time I met my, in other words, I had I was able to have a wide range of heroes as a boy. And I guess my uncle was kind of the last hero I had as a teenager, and maybe the most apt one for me, because unlike my other heroes, he was a writer, and the music and books that he introduced me to have continued to seem right and mean something to me.
For example?
Well, like I think I talk about how he introduced me to this sort of endlessly musical background as you're reading and writing through the day. And so today I myself am kind of emulating that, you know, lots of Handel, lots of Brahms. And
it's so interesting, Edwin. I wish you'd talk about it, because none of us think that, you know, sexuality or is the most important thing we're giving our kids after all. I mean, there's so many other gifts to pass along. What was the core of it for you?
Well, I guess I felt that I was very bohemian, very non-authoritarian, and very hardworking. So it was a sort of strange combination, because I wasn't a hippie sitting around smoking dope and goofing off all day. I was actually writing textbooks at a desperate clip, and then even taking on a full-time job for Celanese, the chemical company, so that I could make enough money to send these kids to school. And so I think they could see there was hard work on one side, but non-authoritarianism in the sense that I, at age 15 and 13 or whatever they were, 16 and 14, I got them their own apartment. Certainly that seems bizarre. And they didn't live with me, nor did I supervise them. I felt these were kids who had problems with authority, and I didn't want to be the authority. I wanted them to conduct their own lives, and I think that showed a certain respect to them and also a desire to maintain my own privacy and independence from them. So we saw each other fairly frequently, but not every day even.
And I would say that at least I was of the temperament that the guilt and the gratitude that I felt regarding my uncle, that sort of had a lasting sort of handle on me than all of my father's threats and so on.
You're teaching them about authority, you're teaching them about work, but you're also teaching them very particularly about writers, composers, a way of life you respected. What were the cardinal principles there?
Well, I think that it was the respect for excellence in art, whether it was rewarded with money or not. In other words, I think that that gay life in the 1970s in New York, that was probably the last flowering of bohemianism in America. And I think it was the last moment when there really was a tradition of honorable poverty, when there really was an idea that people should achieve excellence, not just bestsellerdom. Mm. And I think my nephew has imbibed those principles.
1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with Edmund White and Keith Fleming. Anne is on the line. Welcome, Anne.
Hi. Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
Okay. I just wanted to comment on the one person loving the other person and not exactly the parents, because I was raised by my sister after my mom had passed away when I was 15. And I also grew up in New York with my sister, who was an investment banker, and didn't have a ton of time for me, but really guided me. And I wouldn't be the person I am today without her. And I'm sure you wouldn't be the same person you are today without your uncle.
Yeah.
And I think it's pretty amazing. It's funny because I only heard half of this show so far, but I think it's pretty incredible that one person gives up quite a bit for somebody.
Yeah.
And that's kind
of. Have you told your sister how glad you are that she did that?
Oh, every day.
Yeah.
Even though she lives in New Jersey and I live in Boston, I owe my life to her.
Yeah.
Really.
Well, you should write her a tribute someday.
I was going to say, maybe you should be working on the book about it, Anne.
I know. Maybe that's a good idea. Anyway, I've got to go. I'm on my way to a meeting. But I just really wanted to comment on that because that touched me. And it's nice to know that other people have that one person in their life that truly loves them, you know, without a doubt, and will always be there for them.
And thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Edmund White, did you feel it was part of your mission to educate the taste of your nephew?
Well, I found him a wonderfully absorptive and easily impressed subject. In other words, I can imagine a kind of rowdy or dumb kid who wouldn't have appreciated what I had to offer. I mean, I was very lucky that my nephew was somebody who had the capacity to understand what I wanted to convey to him. But it really never was a kind of preachiness to him. I think he just responded to my personal style and to my taste, and not in every one. I mean, he has his own taste and his own opinions. He's developed in his own direction. But I think that nevertheless, he was open to receive what I wanted to give.
How does this, this is to change the subject a little bit, but I wonder how this bears on the ongoing argument about gay marriage, in your own view, Edmund White.
Well, I think that, first of all, I think gay marriage is a terribly important thing, because I think that marriage is probably the most sacred institution in our culture, and I think if gays finally win the right to be married, that will show that they have finally won total acceptance in our society. I think that, gays who want to adopt, I mean, it's interesting that in countries like Norway or France, where gay marriage exists, it exists in every way except in the right to adopt. And I think that's the crucial thing, is that gays should have the right to adopt. And I think that there's no reason at all why a couple who have the means and the dedication and who've maybe been together, I think maybe they should have been together at least 4 or 5 years before they're allowed to adopt, to show that the couple is really a stable thing. But once that's the case, there's so many kids who are being mistreated in the world, or neglected, or starving, because a lot of gay couples have been adopting third world kids who otherwise would be living in the streets.
But are the two things directly related, the power of gay parenting and the authority or the definition of gay marriage?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that, I agree with Margaret Mead, who once said that she thought there should be two kinds of marriage in our society. One, you could get into and out of easily, and that would be non-procreating marriage. Then there'd be another kind of marriage for couples who wanted to have children, either adopted or naturally born. And those couples, it should be very hard to get married and very hard to get divorced. And I actually believe that. I think she's absolutely right. Mm.
Keith, do you have a view?
I was just thinking that my mother, Ed's sister, is a gay adoptive parent today because she has adopted four children over the last 10 years or so. And they, you know, what are the worries? I'm always trying to try to remember what the concerns even are, that the gay parent will have a negative influence on the children's sexuality. Well, my mother has a 12-year-old son now, adopted son, and a 10-year-old daughter, say, and they're already going on out on their little dates with the opposite sex. And he's playing Little League baseball, and she's going to summer camp. It just, to me, I think if anyone who's worried about gay adoptive parents could just go and take a view of this idyllic family my mother's raising there, would be.
Well, I know what you mean. We have to sort of remind ourselves of what the argument is all about. But what's your own view, Edmund White? Is the argument of has the idea of civil union in Vermont, for example, approached the end of this controversy?
Well, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if other states accept those marriages. I mean, legally they're obliged to, but whether they do or not is another question. Of course, there's a little homophobia in the base of all of this discussion, because we're sort of bending over backwards to say that these gay parents aren't going to influence their children to be gay. But I mean, I think that if they do, where's the problem there? I mean, either we accept homosexuality or we don't. If we do accept it, then I don't see any harm, even if the kids do grow up gay. So what?
What is the argument in gay literature these days, and what's the future of it in a world that seems to lower the barriers a little more all the time?
Well, I think we're actually going through a sort of a golden age of gay writing. I mean, it's interesting because there's so many extraordinary young gay writers right now.
Give us your short list.
Well, I mean, I think that Matthew Stadler, who wrote Alan Stein, is one. Peter Gadol, G-A-D-O-L, who wrote a book called Light at Dusk. There's Robert Gluck, who's a San Francisco writer. There are half a dozen really extraordinary young writers, and I would be hard-pressed to find as many among heterosexuals that I would rush to read. But in any event, I think that there is a lot of activity. But it is true at the same time that gay bookstores are closing down all over the country. They've gone from 75 2 years ago to 50 now, and there'll probably be fewer and fewer. It's partly because it's the Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com phenomenon, that all these things are cheaper. And but they're not all available. That's the trouble, is that Barnes & Noble doesn't carry all of the titles of the small press titles that the gay bookstores traditionally carried, nor does it keep them in stock the way that gay bookstores did. But in any event, I would say that gay fiction is a little threatened by the lack of infrastructure. I mean, in other words, the bookstores closing down. But I think that it happens to be going through a period of enormous expansion right now in terms of talent.
But this is partly the problem of assimilation, isn't it? And as well as of the big retailers. But I also wonder, you know, in a less embattled time, what's the assignment? What's the mission? What's the content? What's the stuff of gay fiction in the future?
Well, I think there still is an awful lot of gay experience that hasn't even begun to be mapped yet. And I think that we've even touched on some of these issues today.
Thank you for doing it. Edmund White and his nephew, Keith Fleming. Keith Fleming's book is called The Boy with the Thorn in His Side. Edmund White's new book is called The Married Man. Thank you both. Thanks to the callers. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Goldsmiths 3, creators of contemporary handcrafted jewelry and precious metals and rare gems. For the complete picture, goldsmiths3.com. By Bakari Restaurant, offering regional Italian cuisine designed to please discriminating